Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Saturday, May 6th, 2017, starting just after 5 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 108th episode of the show. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Nina Griffin about the 146 considerations or aphorisms of the 13th century astrologer Guido Bonatti. Before we get started with the interview, just a couple of announcements about our sponsors and giveaway prizes this month. So each month we do a giveaway prize for patrons of the podcast who donate to help support the production of the show through our page on Patreon, with the winners of each month's giveaway being announced at the end of the month. The first prize this month is a free copy of the astrology software program called Solarfire. Solarfire is one of the most popular astrology programs on the market today and is used by many professional astrologers. In fact, Solarfire is the primary program that I use, and most of the charts that you see here on the podcast website for things like the monthly forecast episodes were generated using Solarfire. The program covers the full range of astrological techniques, including natal astrology, synastry, electional, and horary astrology. It also provides tools from a wide variety of different traditions, from Hellenistic and medieval astrology to Uranian and cosmobiology. I'm excited to announce that listeners of the Astrology Podcast can now get a 15% discount on Solarfire by entering the promo code AP15 when purchasing the program directly through the Solarfire website. You can find out more information about Solarfire at alabe.com. So that's the first prize we're giving away this month. The second prize is a copy of the mobile astrology software app called AstroGold. AstroGold was made by the creators of Solarfire, and it's essentially the mobile version of the popular desktop astrology program. AstroGold features natal, transit, progression, and synastry modules, resulting in a remarkably comprehensive but easy-to-use app for doing astrology on the go. The application is clean, clear, and precise, and uses the latest Swiss Ephemeris and ACS Atlas files, ensuring that the charts cast using the app will be as accurate as possible. The application is available on both iPhones and iOS devices through the iTunes Store, as well as on Android devices through the Google Play Store. It's actually the primary astrology program that I use to cast charts on my Android phone, so I'm excited to be able to promote it through this month's giveaway. For more information about the program, visit astrogold.io. So those are our two giveaway prizes and sponsors this month. All you have to do to enter the giveaway for a chance to win one of these prizes is become a patron of the Astrology Podcast through our page on Patreon on the $5 or $10 tier, and then you'll automatically be entered into the drawing, with the winners of this month's giveaway being announced at the end of the month. More details about the monthly raffle and links to find out more information about each of the prizes can be found on the description page for this episode at theastrologypodcast.com. All right, with those announcements out of the way, let's get started with the interview. Hi, Nina. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, this is a great topic. So what we're talking about today is the 146 considerations of Guido Bonatti and your project recently to illustrate and sort of explicate those considerations. So maybe we should start from square one with just who is this astrologer that we're talking about and who is Guido Bonatti?
So Guido Bonatti is a really interesting character because he is, well, we should start very simply. He was a 13th century Italian astrologer. And the reason he is particularly memorable and we know about him even today is because he was extremely involved in a lot of the historical events of that time. So even though we have a lot of gaps in our knowledge of his biography, there are certain famous names, for example, like the Holy Roman Emperor of that time, or different people who essentially are historically important themselves. And then Guido Bonatti might show up as kind of a footnote. You know, he might have been an astrologer to a famous person, or he might have perhaps determined the time of a well-known battle. So we have these kind of tantalizing glimpses of him and his work, which of course culminated in this huge magnum opus book that he ended up writing, but I suppose we can leave that for a later moment.
Sure. So he's a late medieval writer author writing in the 13th century in Italy, right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Okay. And yeah, so he was the astrologer or court astrologer, perhaps to some notable people, and he shows up in interesting places. Like I think he is mentioned briefly in Dante's Inferno, right?
That's right. He is. He's not the only astrologer mentioned there, but he is probably the one that certainly has left the greatest number of writings and sort of historical artifacts.
Sure. So he wrote this huge book at some point, and we don't know precisely when, but sometime presumably towards the end of his career, he wrote a large treatise on astrology, essentially, right?
Right. It's the Book of Astronomy. And of course, it depends on what kind of printing you have. It has been translated into English, and we'll get into that later. But I think it's well over 1,000 pages in kind of a normal book format. So it is quite hefty.
Yeah, it's a huge book. And so in this book, I guess we can talk about that a little bit at this point. He summarizes a lot of earlier medieval sources, such as Masha'Allah and Saul and Abu Mashar. And then Banati himself went on to be very influential in terms of the later Renaissance tradition, right?
He really did. And I can talk about that a little bit. You know, what's interesting about Banati, as far as we know, it sounds like he had a pretty long life, certainly by the standards of that time. And I remember reading in an earlier text that he was an aristocrat. So he might have either been given a title based on his work with the nobility, or maybe he was born into some kind of a minor noble family. And of course, that helped, you know, get him a lot more prestige and give his writings a lot more credibility over the centuries. But the point that I think you're referring to, Chris, too, is that he was extremely popular until about the 1500s or so. And of course, his works were primarily circulating in manuscript until the invention of the printing press. But what happened is that because his works were so heavily influenced by the Arab and Islamic astrologers of the Middle Ages, a lot of the anti-Islamic sentiment that started coming in with the invasions of the Turks into Europe really cost Banati a lot of popularity. So even though we have him being mentioned in, you know, the 16th century and 17th and 18th, a lot of people kind of lost their taste for him because they felt he was just too strongly influenced by this stream of Islamic thought and astrology that they didn't approve of.
Okay, right. Yeah, that's a good point worth expanding on, because Banati's writing around, let's say, or died around the year 1300. And so he's writing around the time of the 12th century translation movement, where at the beginning of the century, there's not a lot of astrology being practiced in Europe. And then all of a sudden, due to some of the wars that were taking place, there was this rediscovery of astrology, and a bunch of Europeans started flocking to Spain to translate astrological texts from Arabic to Latin. And so Banati, coming at the very end of that century, is one of the first major authors who really drew on that wealth of information from the earlier medieval Arabic astrologers and then compiled it into this large compendium, essentially.
Exactly. And as I understand it, and I'm sure we'll mention Bendix's name a lot during this podcast because he's so important to our ability to access Banati today, but I know a lot of Ben's work has been focused on looking at some of these translations, essentially from Arabic into Latin, which I assume Banati himself would have been relying on when he was learning and compiling his work.
Right, on those Arabic authors. And yeah, and he was drawing on sort of the Arabic texts themselves, but also the Latin translations of the Arabic texts. And so we see sort of glimpses of Banati in different authors. So we see sort of references to him, or sometimes people like William Lilly drawing on Banati. We see some sort of references, like eventually with the early traditional revival, we have Robert Zoller drawing on Guido Banati for his book on the Arabic parts, which is published in 1980 or 1981. But then it wasn't until more recently, actually 10 years ago in 2007, that the first complete translation of Banati into English was carried out and published by Benjamin Dykes, who I actually just had on the last episode to talk about his new translation of Dorotheus' Sidon. So Ben published a full translation of Banati 10 years ago, and contained in that text, one of the sort of sections of it is this section on the 146 considerations or aphorisms, right?
That's exactly right. You know, one of the things as well is that I think Ben's work has just really opened up a great amount, even just his work on Bonatti, which is a fraction of all the work that Ben has done, as I'm sure many of your listeners know. His translation of the Book of Astronomy alone has been a tremendous gift because of Guido Bonatti's ability to distill so many sources into one compendium. And the considerations, of course, are a subset of that. It's the fifth treatise. But this in itself, I think, has opened up our awareness of a lot of these historical sources and the way that they were interpreted by a medieval European astrologer.
Yeah, and that was huge. That was a massive, I mean, that was Ben's very first publication, and just straight out of the gate, you know, he really impressed everyone with this huge text. And, you know, it's funny looking back on it now is I thought, and I sort of assumed, a lot of people assumed, like, there's no way he's ever going to top that. But then he's published almost 20 other amazing translations since then.
He just kept doing it, exactly.
Right, he keeps topping himself. But this was the big one that he sort of hit the scene, came on the scene with. And so we have this huge text, and I've got the original sort of hardcover version, which I'm very lucky to have, which is just
me
huge.
Too.
You have one? Okay, yeah. It's like 600 pages and two volumes with like 600 pages each or 500 pages each. And it's huge, and it's just this massive compendium of medieval astrology. But what's nice about Treatise 5, which is the 146 considerations, is it seems to be Bonatti trying to distill and summarize a lot of the basic principles that he introduces in different parts of his work, right?
That's my understanding as well, Chris. And, you know, I for a long time, and I'll give you a little bit of the history later on, but my understanding of the 146 considerations is that even though it's a list of aphorisms, it nonetheless, there is internal logic and consistency and coherence among them, which is not something you always see in these lists of aphorisms, because sometimes the aphorisms are kind of more just stream of consciousness. Let me just lay down some rules or thoughts or ideas or kind of little bits of astrological lore, which may or may not be connected. But what I think is unique about the 146 considerations is that to me, it almost reads more like a very condensed syllabus for basic grounding in medieval European astrology.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a sort of the sequence to them. It's not as disconnected as some other lists of aphorisms are that I've seen, but instead they kind of build on each other in this nice way.
That's my thought as well.
Sure. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what an aphorism is and that sort of genre of aphorisms that was very popular in the medieval period. So I did a quick search just to get an actual definition. And according to Google, an aphorism is a quote unquote, a pithy observation that contains a general truth or a concise statement of a scientific principle, typically by an ancient classical author. And I think that's a pretty good summary of what an aphorism is. So usually it's like a sentence or like a paragraph that conveys some sort of interpretive principle or some sort of specific astrological principle that's important to understand. But instead of writing an entire book about it, it's condensed into a sort of memorable saying or something like that.
That's exactly right. And one of the things as well, when you look at all of these considerations, some might just be a couple sentences long, but then you'll have a few that are maybe a few pages long. And we'll talk about one of those at least, because there's one that's, I think, particularly notable. That's one of the long ones. But my understanding as well, and we don't really know exactly what was in Bonatti's head when he was writing this, because obviously we don't really have access to his writings about himself, but we can think of the aphorisms, I think, as an adjunct to verbal teaching. And I think this is something that people don't think about today, because today we primarily learn by reading, especially astrology. Of course, you might go to class and you might listen to videos and things like that. But the primary mode of conveying information in the 13th century, if you were a student of pretty much anything, was verbal. And books were expensive. The printing press hadn't yet been invented. And so you definitely see the idea of learning as something that happens primarily in that teacher-student transmission. And because we now have some writing, of course, in medieval Europe, you will get these kinds of maybe outlines or lists, but they're really meant to be aids to the memory rather than the complete knowledge itself. And that is the sense that I get, at least from the 146 considerations.
Sure. Yeah, that's a really great point, because a lot of these, it's almost like a bullet point list of the main points, but it's not fully sort of explicated, but instead it's sort of a reminder about broader principles that you should already know at that point from the oral transmission, from learning from your teacher, or from, you know, perhaps as in the case with Banati, reading the longer discussions where he goes on for pages and pages. But with this, it's really just summarizing the core principles that you need to remember.
Precisely.
Okay. So, and this was not unique, but this is part of a broader genre that had been around for a few centuries at this point. And there's also other lists of medieval astrological aphorisms, right?
There are, and certainly not just medieval. I mean, there is Ptolemy's Syntiloquy, you know, and you have, I mean, I can think of certainly William Lilly, who's not medieval, but really more of a late Renaissance writer, or even, you know, early modern in some cases. Or you could look at it, for example, as a lot of the physician, sort of medical astrological texts for physicians that came out of medieval and Renaissance Europe, since there was so much overlap between the two disciplines at the time, had a tremendous number of aphorisms. And the aphorisms would be, sometimes they'd be kind of strictly medical, you know, the color of urine means this for a patient. But they would also, there would be an astrological one that followed. And so you realize this is something that most likely permeated a lot of the sciences, and just the way that both astrology and other kinds of knowledge was taught.
Yeah, and in the philosophical tradition, especially with the Stoics, there were lists of what were essentially aphorisms, like by Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher from the first or second century. Even Marcus Aurelius's Meditations almost take on that form of like short aphorisms.
That's right.
So, yeah, and then let's see, other publications. In 2008, for example, James Holden published a set of five different short texts of aphorisms by different medieval astrologers titled Five Medieval Astrologers, and that contains some other early lists of aphorisms from prior to Banati, such as the Syntiloquy of 100 Aphorisms attributed to Ptolemy, or Abu Mashar's Book of Flowers, or another list of aphorisms attributed to Bethen, or some say to Ibn Ezra. So there's other sort of works like this floating around in that period.
Absolutely. And I can't help but wonder, Chris, you know, what the prospective audience was for this, whether it was something that was intended to be circulated, because obviously often the list itself isn't enough for a full book. You know, they might be relatively brief, just a few pages. Or again, was this something that was supposed to be sort of handed around by students? I think the history of it as a way of conveying information is quite interesting, and unfortunately a little bit mysterious as well.
Sure. And that actually brings up a really good point, which is that this, his considerations is really one of the few things that has been transmitted relatively continuously over the past several hundred years after Banati's death. And that even though it wasn't until 2007 that a full translation of Banati's complete work was actually published by Benjamin Dykes, there was a previous English translation. One of the earliest English works on astrology was a translation of Banati's aphorisms at some point in the 17th century, right?
That's right. It was translated by the well-known English astrologer William Lilly and his student Henry Coley. It's called the Anima Astrologiae, or I guess literally the Soul of Astrology, or the English name was A Guide for Astrologers. And this was published in the late 1600s, so I think 1676. What's interesting about that particular work, and I'll just say a quick thing about it, is that as far as I understand, you know, it's kind of a fun read in a way, because it's sort of, you know, it's a little bit idiomatic, and it has kind of Lilly's, I would say, kind of folksy manner, although it's not necessarily super accurate as a translation.
Sure. I think Ben says in his commentary in one of the footnotes, because when he went through and translated Banati's considerations, he also compared it to that. That was the only other English translation, is this one from 1776 by Coley and Lilly. And he said in one of the first footnotes that Coley's translation appears to be more of a paraphrase and that it omits some passages and some sentences entirely.
Exactly. And, you know, as I think you have, I'm sure, seen very often with translations, is that even translations that purport to be exact often aren't, and important things get left out. You know, I know, as Ben was discussing with his most recent translation of Dorotheus. And so I'm sure that a practicing astrologer might just say, you know what, this is kind of silly. I don't need this sentence right here. And you know, probably what he thinks to be important is going to take a back seat, or rather is going to take a front seat to whatever the actual content is going to be.
Right. Yeah, that's always the challenge with translating. And that's always the challenge with astrologers translating astrological text, is that sometimes difference between them wanting to translate it very literally and sticking to the text versus sometimes interpreting what they think the author meant, which sometimes involves changing things, especially if you're dealing with a written manuscript where the possibility of errors or, you know, mistaken alterations to the text is more prevalent.
That's exactly right. And astrologers have a lot of opinions, so I think it's really difficult to avoid introducing that, especially if you run into a text that might be ambiguous in certain parts and you have to take some kind of stand.
Sure. So despite the deficiencies, though, so this was the first translation of Bonatti's Considerations, and it's really one of the only pieces of Bonatti's huge 1,000-page text that sort of survived, because it was translated and widely printed in 1676. And then I know in the 20th century, it wasn't like widely used, but there were a few different reprints of that translation. And I actually, it's one of the first, as just sort of like a personal anecdote, it's one of the first books on traditional astrology that I ever came across was a reprinted version of that translation, I think around 2004 or 2005, when I was trying to learn about horary and electional astrology for the first time. I found it at the Astrology et al. Bookstore and picked it up and started reading it. And that was really my first exposure to medieval astrology. So this text has kind of been around for a little bit, but then in 2007, when Ben published his, and that was just a turning point, because he provides a lot of commentary and a lot of helps to unpack the text a little bit, right?
I think he really does. And that's something that Ben does very well. You know, he's very good at adding comments and adding a little bit of information about when there is something that's not clear. Instead of just kind of going forward and choosing an interpretation, he will very often annotate it and say, okay, well, this could have this particular meaning, or here is this possible reference to an older text that Bonatti's most likely drawing on. But actually, I have a question for you, Chris. So what about the 146 Considerations made you want to get that book at the time? Do you remember?
Yeah, well, the issue I ran into is in 2004, I wanted to pick like an electional chart for something. I think it was for like signing a lease with an apartment with a friend, but it was like a kind of unreliable friend. And I was a little really nervous because I knew that practically speaking, this was a terrible idea to get an apartment with this friend. So I wanted to hedge my bets by using this thing I just recently learned about, which is the concept of electional astrology. But I was looking around and there was almost no modern textbooks on electional astrology, which was kind of surprising to me at the time. I was at Kepler and I had just spent a year learning about the history of astrology. So I knew that elections and horary astrology were very prominent in the previous tradition. But for some reason, I couldn't find any modern astrology textbooks talking about it. So when I actually came across this little booklet, and it wasn't very long, it was only, you know, 50 pages or less than 100 pages. And I saw that it had specific rules of what you need to do for not just horary questions, but also electional charts. I grabbed it because it was like finding like a hidden ancient tome that was like from the 13th century or the 12th century. So I was pretty excited.
Right. And I imagine that's how a lot of us got into traditional astrology, you know, the sense of that you just discovered some kind of ancient treasure, sort of like an Indiana Jones experience or something.
Right.
And yeah, it makes sense that a lot of these topics, I feel, really have not been as popularized in the 20th and 21st centuries. So anyway, that's a good story. Thank you.
And when did you first read the Considerations? Did you read them first in the Henry Coley version, or did you read them first in Ben's version?
I read them first in the Henry Coley version, and I had difficulties with it. I think the edition I got, I forget the name of, I think it's like, is it Keplinger, something like that. It's like a yellow covered, you know, facsimile series. And
yeah, that's the one I got as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the only one that was out there around that time. And I remember reading it, and it's, you know, partly the font is kind of terrible because it's a facsimile. And, but also I remember reading it and I'm just thinking like, this is really kind of weirdly disjointed and you kind of want a little bit more depth. But again, I wasn't really recognizing that this is just really meant to be an outline or a guide. And I would imagine that as a student reading it, you're probably intended to do further investigation yourself. You know, he just kind of gives you that first clue, but then you're expected to go to, I don't know, other teachers or other texts to learn that particular issue or item in depth.
Right. It's like the Cliff Notes version of an astrology book, where it's just like a list of the bullet points of the main points without all the stuff in between. So it's like if you read a synopsis of, you know, the movie Titanic or something like that, without actually watching the two or three hour movie.
That's exactly right. So that was my experience of it. I found it intriguing, but I also found it, you know, given the lack of, I think, texts that were available in English at the time to kind of support it, I also found it somewhat frustrating.
Yeah. And so that actually is a nice segue then to your current project, which is that you're actually in the process of doing a sort of commentary and like an illustrated version, essentially, of Banati's considerations, right? Is that an accurate way of sort of talking about what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a really good summary. And it's a little bit hard to describe because it's neither entirely written nor entirely illustrated. But my goal for something like this, and I should give you a little bit of background, I have always wanted to do kind of the expanded version of the considerations. In other words, a version of the considerations that you don't need to go too much outside the text to really learn each of the considerations and understand it in depth. And just because most people, you know, I think most of us are not going to be that motivated to look it up in three different texts and try to collate it and understand maybe what Banati said, even though that would be the ideal way to approach it. But I think the reality is that most of us just don't have that kind of time or patience, perhaps. So my goal was to initially, this started maybe 3-4 years ago, is to simply write a book, and each consideration would merit a chapter, and maybe I'd have an illustrative chart. But the problem is that it was still fairly dry because I was really just pulling together material with my own gloss on it, but it felt a little bit removed. And I felt that if I wasn't having fun kind of writing it, I didn't feel people would really have fun reading it. So some time ago, I started creating kind of these notes really just for myself, where I would, you know, kind of write a little bit about the consideration, maybe rephrase it in my own words or try to kind of get at the heart of what Banati seems to be saying, with some illustrations about how this might manifest in practice. And a lot of the considerations, as I think you hinted, are, you know, a lot of them are horary based, though quite a few are electional as well as natal. And sometimes Banati will give you one consideration that he'll explicitly say, you know, this covers natal and electional or horary and electional or something like that. And so my goal was to try to bring it into kind of a 21st century vernacular, because a lot of these things, you know, they have to be made, in my opinion, accessible. And then also I enjoyed illustrating them because a lot of these metaphors that sort of emerge out of a lot of these horary and electional concepts are very visual. And so I thought, you know, why not kind of put some drawings around it and make it a little bit more interesting to look at? And I feel like it's something I've enjoyed doing. And so I started sharing it on social media, and I think people have really responded to it much more than I would have expected, honestly.
Yeah, the reaction has been amazing, just because a lot of people know about the considerations, but it is this kind of, as you said, a kind of dry thing that really needs, you know, to be brought alive a little bit more through commentary, but also through illustration. And the lack of diagrams and examples in the considerations make their usefulness a little bit limited. But when you started posting those pictures of your illustrations, it really brought alive a lot of the concepts that are contained in the considerations. So I know for me personally, I was excited to see somebody doing that, because it was something that was much needed to bring the sort of spotlight on what was a very important but somewhat difficult text to understand. And doing it in that way with that sort of artistic flair, I thought was a really nice touch. So I'm excited that you're doing that.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. I'm glad you think so. And it is one of those things that I think, you know, I know, again, we come back to Ben just because it's, again, it's hard to have this conversation without really sort of appreciating his contribution. You know, he's been translating a ton of texts, starting with Bonatti, and a lot of them are just, you know, all of them are extremely important. But at the same time, I think a lot of people might be intimidated by some of that material. And so I wish I could illustrate as fast as Ben translates, but I can't. But I feel that a lot of it is, you know, just kind of bringing things out and making it a little bit easier for people to bridge that gap between how they, you know, the kind of vernacular and the kind of reading that they might be doing today as people living today, and then accessing and approaching these old texts, which sort of require their own mindset and their own immersion.
Right. Yeah. Ben and I were talking about that in the last episode with some of the electional considerations from Dorotheus and how sometimes you need to translate, in that case, it was like first century Roman or Greco-Roman society and some of the things that were normal back then, and how even some of the things that seem kind of bizarre to us from a societal standpoint, how you can read between the lines and figure out what the underlying meaning is, or at least an attentive reader can, and then take that and apply it to or figure out how it applies to modern day society. And it seems like that's part of your program with this as well, right?
It is. I mean, I suppose in that sense, it's a little easier since I'm only trying to bridge about 800 years instead of, I don't know, 2000. But nonetheless, it's still a challenge. You know, and I think part of it too is just, you know, our conception of what a book is has changed. You know, whereas nowadays we have, at least in the West, we have nearly universal literacy. And so books have to appeal to a pretty broad range of people, even within the astrology world. Whereas back then, the only people reading texts, and especially texts like this, would really be scholars and professionals and people with a pretty high degree of education who might have maybe more of a constitutional tolerance for this kind of relatively dry reading.
Yeah, that's a good point, that there's all these different intermediary steps. It's like you have the original Latin text, which is written by Bonatti in the 12th century or in the 13th century. And then you have, you know, Ben translating the text. And then you have, you know, somebody like you or me who has a background in traditional astrology who can read the text and understand it. And then you have, you know, like a general astrological audience that may or may not have that sort of background and needs help understanding what this text is trying to convey and needs it to be unpacked a little bit.
That's my feeling as well. And you know, Bonatti doesn't always make it easy. I'm just going through, just finishing up a set, one of these considerations that has like, you know, 15 subparts or something, where he doesn't even define terms. He just kind of says the term, but he doesn't say what it means or where it applies or what it is, which to me seems very clear that you're probably meant to go look it up in your own, you know, Latin or Arabic texts because you're a scholar and presumably you have access to some of this. But until very recently, and largely thanks to Ben, we haven't been able to even look it up, whereas today at least we can do that.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. So maybe we should talk then, maybe we should actually get into some of the considerations and talk about, you know, the content of some of them, and maybe talk about some of the most interesting considerations and some of the weirdest ones that are the most out there. You mentioned briefly earlier, I mean, there's a few of them that are a little bit out there. I think we'll put that off until later, but it seems like as I was just reviewing some of them today, it's like right off the bat, he starts off in the early considerations talking about horary astrology. And that really seems to be one of the dominant themes throughout the consideration, to the extent that it almost seems like that's his primary practice, even though elsewhere in the book, in his, you know, large 1,000-page treatise, he does talk about natal astrology and mundane and electional. And occasionally the considerations touch on that, but it seems like the majority or the greater emphasis of this is on horary, right?
That's my understanding as well. And like I said, he will talk a lot about natal, especially toward the end of the 146. But you're right, he definitely starts out strong with horary.
Okay. So let's talk about, I mean, there were two illustrations that you did. What was your first illustration in the series, or what considerations did that focus on?
Well, I try to do them in order just because, you know, like I said earlier, the text is, you know, it does have some internal organization. So I tried to keep it in as order as much as I can. And I apologize if there are sounds of me turning pages because I wanted to look at it while I spoke to you. But the consideration that I started out with was, of course, the first, and some of them go together. And since the illustrations that I do all have to fit on a 9x12 page, I can fit in one if it's very complicated, and sometimes I'll fit in three, you know, if they're kind of shorter or if their themes overlap to some extent. And so the first consideration and the second talks about what makes a horary question appropriate and radical, which of course is a term of art. So I looked at some of these, some of the concepts that Bonatti introduces, and some of these are actually very well known in that, you know, you have these heavenly bodies that then impress their essence onto the mundane or physical objects or people or beings that are here kind of on Earth. And they either cause them to move. You know, he's a little bit vague on this point, I'm sure due to issues of theology and censorship and things like that. But he discusses how a horary question essentially is born, how it comes about, and how a querent, which is the technical term for the person asking the horary question who comes to the astrologer, should act when they ask their question. You know, they should pray, they should approach it with great respect, you know, and they need to really, you know, sort of involve themselves profoundly in the act of asking a question. So I thought the most appropriate way to illustrate it, of course, would be with hedgehogs. And so that's one of the things that I did with my work, is I tried to kind of show through kind of these little cartoons, through, you know, the watercolor medium that I use, you know, how it might look when these heavenly bodies are imprinting their influences on earthly things, and what that would entail for a person asking a question.
Right. So the first considerations are really about what moves a person to ask a horary question, and the notion almost the importance of the question, or what the querent's motivation is in some sense.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Okay. And I think you, for example, you used the example of, or what's the breakdown for that, I guess I should say, in terms of, it seems like he wants, and maybe this can get into some broader philosophy or what your personal practicing philosophy is in terms of horary questions, where the first considerations almost seems to be dealing with this question of, you know, is the question important, or is it based on some either pressing or some broader significant manner, versus is the question, you know, not important or not significant, or is it sort of like a trifling question or something like that? Is that the gist of the first few considerations, or how did you sort of read that?
So I read the first and second considerations together because they seem to flow from one another. And so the first one is the one where it discusses, you know, the impression of the influences of the heavenly bodies onto earthly bodies. But then, of course, he does get into this interesting sentence, which is, the motion of the free will, which I will quote, which can't itself be an act of the one asking, because even though the soul is moved to ask, it doesn't suffice unless the superior bodies lead him to pose the question. Nor does the motion of the stars suffice unless from the motion of the free will, the act of asking is reached. And I'd be curious to know what you think, Chris, because my reading of his introduction of free will here, which is, it feels a little bit like a non sequitur. I mean, I suppose he needs to have it in there to kind of round out the philosophy of it. But there was also a very real reason that if he's writing a book on astrology, it's best to mention the importance of free will, because, of course, that would be something that would potentially get him in trouble with any kind of censors or anybody else who might be reading this from the church.
Right. Yeah. And it's like that, because he's writing within the context of like late medieval or like the high medieval period, and the Catholic Church being a sort of dominant institution. And so sometimes it seems like he's paying lip service. Other times, you know, he does seem to have, and this gets tied into other things like the so-called considerations before judgment, and this question of whether the question is rooted in something, or the need to root the question in something that's solid. It seems to be like a reoccurring theme for Bonatti, and I know that it's something that Ben comes back to a few times in his commentary on this and his introduction to Bonatti's work. And that seems sort of slightly connected to some of these early considerations as well.
Yes, that's certainly my reading of it. And so in the first consideration, Bonatti just lays out kind of the theory. And then in the second one, he shows you, the astrologer, or you, the potential querent, how you might be able to come up with the question that is most appropriate and most likely to be sort of blessed by these heavenly bodies, and that is correctly in tune with the times, and you know, most likely to give you the answer that you will desire. So he's got some very pretty well known, I would say, instructions. You know, is that you have if you have a question, is that you approach it, you know, with a contrite spirit, and that you pray to God from whom every good beginning leads. You know, there's the sense that ultimately, whatever happens, you really do need to reach out to your deity, which of course in this case would be the Judeo-Christian God. And then also he says, okay, you really need to have a question that you have considered for at least a day and a night, because, you know, that way you're not going to ask anything that is trivial or just a slight motion of the mind or anything like that.
Right. So there's this real sense that Horary questions for him, at least in this instance, or at least the way that he's outlining it initially, are for, you know, important matters in some sense, or that it's a question that really moves the querent to ask, even after thinking about it for ideally, you know, something like a day and a night, so a 24-hour period, so that they know that it's something really important that they really want to get an answer to from the astrologer.
That's exactly right. Yes. I think he gives that. It's interesting that he shares that with an astrologer, because obviously as the reader of this text, you're more likely to be the person reading the chart. But it also, I suppose, as an astrologer, helps give your client instructions, maybe if they don't know how to ask, or for you to judge whether the question that they brought you is something that you should be looking at and that you should be judging it, because perhaps they literally just thought of it and it's something that wouldn't qualify under these rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think it might be tied into, it's like in the early medieval tradition, you have rules that are not as prominent in the later medieval and especially Renaissance tradition, where sort of asking your own question became more common and more sort of just a typical thing. Whereas you've got earlier authors like Masha Allah saying, for whatever reason, that the astrologer should not ask their own question. And I think, I don't know where Banati ends up siding. I think he repeats that at some point, but he does. I'm not sure that he necessarily follows it. But that could be the reason why there's more of this concern about like instructing through these rules, instructing it from the position of as if you're almost like the client from that standpoint, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I kind of wonder if at the time, given that, you know, to get a chart set and interpreted, you had to have somebody who, you know, who knew how to cast a chart and who knew mathematics and who knew astrology. So in fact, that person had to be fairly well educated by the standards of the time. So I wonder how easy it was for, you know, if you wanted to go as an astrologer to get your question answered, how many colleagues could you really rely on that you felt like, okay, their math was good and their interpretive skills were good. So maybe a lot of people still felt very comfortable, you know, or they had to perhaps answer their own questions.
Sure. Yeah, that would actually make for an interesting sort of discussion and study at some point, because I've always wanted to get more into that and show the talk about some of the different ways that Horary was practiced in different eras, or where the emphasis was in different time periods versus sort of shifted in later eras. So, okay, so those are the first three. So the first three are kind of like preliminary considerations, essentially, to asking Horary questions. And that's the subject of your first illustration of the first three considerations. But then eventually, he sort of jumps right into some different technical considerations for answering Horary questions, and the ways in which sort of connections between planets can come about or be completed, essentially, right?
That's exactly right. And the fourth consideration is where he really sort of lets you have it, I think, because you get, I think, about 15 different types that are in this fourth consideration of ways that matters can come about or not come about. And for that, he will give you literally just the name. So the first one, he says, the first is the arrival or advancement of things or in things, which the philosophers call, and he said something like alcohol, not actually alcohol, but it'll be these weird sort of gibberish Arabic names, I guess, or words that I assume came down from all the different manuscripts being copied by hand and errors being made by scribes who didn't know what they were transliterating. And so he'll give you the sort of quasi-Arabic or pseudo-Arabic word, but he doesn't define it in any way. He doesn't say what kind of arrival or advancement is, even though he is quite clearly drawing on some earlier Arabic sources. I think in this case, it's primarily Abu Mashar And potentially Alcabisi as well.
Sure. So he talks about, and the way you titled this, drawing on the translation, was 16 ways that matters are created and destroyed. And a lot of these are talking about the sort of dynamic, almost aspect doctrine that was used that really developed or became fully matured in the medieval tradition about different ways that planetary significators in the chart can either move towards an exact aspect in the chart or separate from an exact aspect in the chart or different variations of that, essentially. So different types of applications and separations or things broadly sort of related to that, essentially, right?
Right. So he'll talk about kind of more common ideas such as, you know, translation of light or collection of light, things that do come up, especially in the horary context, I would say primarily. But then things that are a little bit more obscure that even though they were pretty important, I think, for the Arabic writers, they've sort of fallen out of fashion. So you talk about the ideas of, you know, returning a virtue and pushing a virtue and what that means. He doesn't tell you, so you would have to go to some other source. And I tried to define it right there in my notes so that you don't have to go to a different book to try to pull it all together.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that because then it acts like a commentary on these just very short statements on his part where you're actually expanding on what these different modes of perfection are, essentially. And so for our audience, so assuming, let's just say hypothetically, that the audience doesn't know very much about horary astrology, one of the primary ways maybe you can explain that questions are answered is that, let's say, a client comes to an astrologer, they ask a question about whether some event will take place in the future. And then the astrologer looks at the chart and they look at, let's say, the planetary ruler of the ascendant, and then the planetary ruler of the house under consideration. And one of the approaches is to see if those two planets are applying to an exact aspect with each other, in which case sometimes the answer then is affirmative, or if they're separating from an exact aspect or not making any aspect whatsoever, in which case the answer is negative. Would you say that that's sort of a broadly accurate in terms of one of the primary approaches to answering horary questions?
Definitely. Certainly there is more to it than just aspects, but I think that's the first thing that everyone learns, and with good reason, because it is a big part of the way that you would analyze a chart, is that you would try to identify the planet representing the person asking the question, and then the planet that represents the thing or person being asked about. And presumably, you know, a lot of questions, not all of them, but many are concerned with issues, you know, will I get the job or will I get the, you know, the girl or whatever. So you're trying to bring these two planets together, ideally. And so what Bonatti is doing in this particular consideration, and others as well, is showing you ways that planets might come together that are maybe a little bit more involved than just, for example, one planet applying to the other. You know, what if there's a third planet that they both aspect? You know, you might get a collection of light, for instance. So he's trying to show you all these different, essentially, patterns for movements of the planets that you should watch out for when you're doing your analysis of a horary.
Sure. So essentially, once you take that idea that metaphorically one planet in the chart is going to signify or metaphorically represent the person who asked the question, and then one of the planets in the chart is going to represent symbolically the thing that was inquired about, and you start looking at the relationship between those two planets in the chart, you realize that there's a lot of different ways that they can interact. And he essentially tries to write a synopsis of 16 primary ways that they can interact. So, and this is what you're in the middle of it, illustrating these 16 right now, right? Or have you completed that?
I'm just about to complete them. Yes. I think it took several pages because some of them are more involved than others. You know, for example, the concept of reception, I think, merited one entire page by itself. And I'm not even sure that was sufficient.
Yeah, it's a pretty big concept, and it's something that he comes back to over and over again, the idea of reception. So maybe a good starting point, it would just be the first few. I mean, what is arrival, or what he calls advancement? Is that essentially application, right?
That's my understanding as well, is that you are really just looking at planets applying to each other. They're, you know, it's a fairly straightforward thing. But then later, as you go through these sort of subsections in this fourth consideration, you realize that advancement or arrival or application is really insufficient necessarily. You know, you might need something a little bit more. You might need reception or something else to ensure perfection that, you know, you and the thing you're asking about are actually brought together.
Sure. So why don't we do that then? Or let's just build on those as building blocks and go sort of, you know, application versus what separation would indicate, then sort of segue into reception. So you've got hypothetically the planet that represents the querent and the planet that represents what was inquired about or the subject in question, and they're in an application. So you would say then in that instance, for just broadly speaking, a hoary question, that would answer or indicate an affirmative answer or at least a coming together of those two things in the future, essentially.
Right, right. And so, you know, just to sort of clarify, to arrival or advancement, he says, yes, that's application, but really it's when you're dealing with planets that are angular. In other words, they are in one of the houses that's, you know, house 1, 4, 7, and 10. And which he says it's something that helps planets be brought together. So if you are the moon and the thing you're asking about is Mars, and you see them coming together, it's generally much more favorable to see one or both planets in angular houses to help ensure that the matter really does come about.
Okay, sure. And then the opposite of that would be separation, which is when the two planets are moving away from an exact aspect, like moving away from a conjunction, let's say. And what's the situation in that scenario if you've got a separation between the two primary significators in a horary question?
So separation indicates that you and the matter are probably on opposite courses, and unless there's something else going on in the chart, all other things being equal, you are not going to be, you know, getting that thing because the distance between you is separating. Later on in the considerations, Bonatti talks about this in greater length, and he also talks about this in the horary section of his treatise, which is a separate book entirely, where he essentially says that whenever you see significators that are separating, but they're still in orb, you know, they're still within that aspect, the degrees, it means that you might still be sort of influenced by or influencing the thing you're asking about, but you're essentially on a trajectory that is slowly allowing matters to deteriorate. So I think his example was like an engagement. You know, when you're asking, will I marry this person? And you're seeing the significator separating while the planets are still in orb with each other, while they're sort of still within sort of sighting distance, it may mean that the engagement will go on. But because the planets are drawing further from each other, the relationship will eventually fall apart.
Right. And he has like an interesting comment or commentary there where he cites the earlier medieval author Saul and says that Saul says that they're not truly separating until they're a degree apart. But then he says he sort of interjects his own comment and says, however, I think that as soon as a planet is even a minute, just a slightly past the exact aspect and starting to separate or move away, that's already enough to indicate that the matter is in the past rather than something coming up in the future, right?
That's right. And I'm actually curious what you think about this, Chris, because there is not, as far as I know, any kind of consensus in the tradition about when a planet is considered separated. You know, in the older texts, I mean, we see it being 1 degree, but obviously that, you know, when something's separated by a minute, it's already separated. And I don't know if that just comes from inexactitude because of, you know, not very exact, you know, ephemerides or something like that. Whereas in more recent times, we're able to figure out where planets are much more reliably to the minute. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get in any trouble since I don't know if this is like a contemporary issue still where contemporary practitioners like argue about whether it, you know, as soon as it's separating by even a minute that it's over, or if there's some who argue that if it's by, it has to be more than a degree or something like that, and it's not until then that it's over. Is that actually a contemporary debate?
Not that I know of. I think if you ask most people today, they would simply say, look, if it's a minute away, it's already separating. But you know, again, we do have these old texts that seem to say, so I don't think you're going to get in too much trouble with anybody living. How about that?
Okay, good. Yeah, I mean, as soon as it's separating for me, usually, you know, because we can know exactly, then it's something that's moving into the past just through that basic idea of aspects that are applying indicate things in the future, and aspects that are separating indicate things moving into the past. So that's pretty straightforward for me. And you can see that sometimes, especially if you're doing like live charts, like with solar fire, and looking at like a live animation for an event chart or something like that for an electional chart. Sometimes you can see that moment of exactitude and the two points in time immediately before and after it. And sometimes it is very stark in terms of whether it's still applying or whether it's still separating. So to me, that's a pretty straightforward sort of distinction.
No, it's true. There are probably other things that are a little bit more ambiguous that we can worry about.
Right. So that then provides a nice segue to one of the recent things where in connection with this and in connection with the concept of reception, you drew on Banati, I think, in order to create a nice sort of infographic on the concept of reception and the perfection of aspects and how it can help to, you know, fully improve the condition of the connection between two planets, or sometimes how that can be very weak. So do you want to talk about that a little bit, how reception works and how it's tied into this issue of planets or significators perfecting in a horary chart?
I'd be happy to. You know, and reception is something that is, I think, our sort of a 20th century common understanding of reception is pretty different than medieval or later understanding of reception. And so I should clarify that I would say probably many, if not most of your listeners are familiar with the concept of mutual reception as defined in the 20th century, where if you have two planets in each other's signs, then they are in mutual reception. So for example, if you have, Venus in Capricorn and Saturn in Libra, then you have mutual reception because each planet is in the sign that the other planet rules. So a visual of this that I always try to present is, you know, you have a king visiting the neighboring king, and then the neighboring king goes to the other kingdom. So they kind of swap places. You know, that's essentially mutual reception. However, reception as such is a little bit more, I think, nuanced. And so please feel free to, you know, fill in whatever I might leave out. But essentially, reception in the traditional sense seems to, in a lot of texts, seems to require a major aspect between the planets, which is not something that's typically taught in a more modern context. And then also reception can occur through not just rulership, but some of the other dignities that a planet might have. And, for instance, if you're looking at Capricorn, Saturn rules it, and then Mars is the exaltation ruler, and then you have your triplicity rulers, and then what's called bound or termulars, as well as face rulers. And each of these dignities is progressively less important or less powerful than the first. So you can have all these different dignity relationships. So a Venus in Capricorn might be in the rulership of Saturn and received by him there, but she's also received by Mars because he's the exaltation lord. And then the same thing for triplicity rulers and so forth. And so again, there's a lot more to it than that, but that's essentially what reception is that a planet is visiting essentially a part of the zodiac that's governed by other planets with different degrees of power. And it is able or not able to act depending on the visiting planet's relationship to its hosts. I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's a really great way of defining it. And just this notion of, and what you really bring out in this graphic on your website at ninagriffin.com is just the idea that Banati really emphasizes over and over again in the considerations. And then at one point has a long digression about at some point in his book where saying that, you know, sometimes it's not sufficient, or at least it's not ideal, especially in horary questions, just for the two planets to be applying to an aspect, but that it's actually better and they'll have a much stronger connection, which can help you feel much more sure about the outcome of the question if they also have some sort of zodiacal affinity between each other, or at least that's the terminology I would use for reception, is this idea of, you know, does a planet have some sort of affinity or some sort of rulership over the specific sign in question, and that can help to strengthen the relationship between two planets if they don't just have an aspectual relationship with each other, but also they One of them is in the sign ruled by the other, or in one of the lesser dignities, or two of the lesser dignities in some instances, of the other planet.
Right. And so the graphic that I created is based on a part of Bonatti's book that's not in the considerations, it's outside of it, but it speaks to it so well that I thought it'd kind of enrich people's understanding, again, without hopefully having to go to too many outside sources, outside of the 146 considerations. And so he gives you essentially this graduated list of matters coming about from the most easy way of perfecting a matter to the most difficult and unlikely way that something might happen. And the chart that I created is something that just says, okay, here is what needs to happen for it to be what he calls easiest of all. And he'll say the matter perfects most easily. And this is my paraphrase because of space constraints and also just to modernize it a little bit. When the querent significator or planet is in the house signifying the matter or vice versa. In other words, if you asked, will you get the job? Well, it's really nice if the planet that signifies you is in the part of the chart that signifies the job, because it means that you are going to get there. It's certainly not the only thing, but to Bonatti, that was an indication that, you know, the matter would come about very easily. Or he says, if the significators are conjoined, right? Because a conjunction is considered to be a particular powerful way of bringing planets and things together. So with reception, he'll say something like, you know, the next step down in this sort of hierarchy of ease is that matters still come about easily and the matter will perfect without striving or any difficulty when the two planets are joined by a trine or a sextile with reception. And of course, trine and sextile are the aspects that supposedly make things happen, you know, very easily. And they're the aspects of friendship and love, as one of the texts had it. And if there's reception, so in other words, if one of the planets is also being hosted essentially by the other planet, then that just gives you, as you say, additional assurance that there's going to be a harmonious and giving relationship between these two planets and that the matter you're asking about will happen.
Okay. So let's give an example. Let's say it's like a relationship query question, like, you know, will I and such be married next year or something like that? And so one of the highest ones in this hierarchy where he says the matter will come about easily is if the planet in the Hori chart that signifies the person who asked the question and the planet in the chart that represents the one that the question was asked, the topic that was asked about, if those two planets are applying within a few degrees or let's say with an orb through a trine or a sextile as one condition, and then on top of that, they also have reception. So let's say, best case scenario, one of the two planets is in the domicile of the other planet or the sign that the other planet rules, just to keep it simple for a basic audience. And that's one of the best case scenarios, essentially, is that there's both an applying easy aspect, and then there's also reception between the two planets, right?
Yep, that's pretty much the ideal scenario. And it's accordingly rare, I would say. It's not often that we see something like that. Yeah. And so should I go to the next step then?
Sure. Or maybe actually so what would that look like if you had a seventh house question? Can you think of like an example or just like a hypothetical?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just trying to think what would be a good example. So I don't know. Let's say that you have, you know, that your significators are Venus and Mars, since obviously a romance question. And then Mars was, let's say, in Pisces, because that is the sign where Venus has her exaltation. So she has some power in that sign. And let's see, Mars in Pisces, and then Venus would have to be in, well, I guess we can say that Venus could be in Capricorn, let's say, right? Because that's the place where Mars is exalted. So this would actually be a mutual reception, although we certainly wouldn't need to have that. But in this case, so Venus is applying to Mars, and this would happen very easily because the relationship between them from Capricorn to Pisces is a sextile, and it is happening with reception. And in this case, it's essentially a double reception. Each planet receives the other. But this could also work if, for example, Mars was still in Pisces, but Venus was in, let's say, I don't know what's a good example. I don't know, I was going to say Virgo, but that's an opposition and that wouldn't work. But if Venus was in, I don't know, Taurus, for instance, right? So if Venus is applying to Mars out of Taurus, yeah, you've still got a sextile, and she is receiving Mars again into her exaltation into Pisces. So that would be a wonderful indication that most likely this relationship, yes, would lead to marriage in the time frame that you specified.
Okay. So let's say, so that's best case or one of the best case scenarios. Then what's the next step down? What's the one just below that that's not coming about as easily?
So it's a very similar scenario. And Bonatti says that the matter still perfects without striving, even if there is no hope. Although I wonder the reason that he says there is no hope is that there is some hint now that the situation is perhaps not as obviously heading toward perfection, you know, just in your own understanding as the querent. And so here he says, the significators of the querent and quesited are joined by a trine without reception or a sextile with reception. And the perception here that is that a trine is still somehow more powerful and able to affect things harmoniously than a sextile, which is kind of a junior trine, if you will. So if it's a trine, you don't need reception. You most likely will still get the outcome you're asking about. But if you're asking about if you're looking at a sextile, you still need that reception because the sextile is a little bit weaker and you need the extra insurance of reception for it to work.
Okay, got it. So reception then, it just acts as this additional secondary factor that can help strengthen almost the relationship between the planets in order to ensure an easy and favorable outcome in terms of the perfection between those two planetary significators.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
So what's next after that or what?
Yeah, so the next step down is when we, I think, take a significant step down, and he says the matter will come about, but with striving. So you're going to have to make an effort, or the other person will have to make an effort, or, you know, somebody's going to have to do something. You can't just kind of sit back and hope that the matter will perfect. And he says that when the significators of the querent and quesited are joined by a square aspect with reception, or a sextile aspect without reception. And a square aspect, of course, is associated with some difficulty. It still brings planets together, so it's better than nothing. But here, again, we're kind of in the middle of that ladder that Bonatti has laid out. And a square with reception is, you know, it means you'll have to make an effort. A square signifies, you know, tension and having to make you'll have to strive for this outcome. Or if you can get a sextile without reception, that's about equivalent to that square with reception. So there's some equivalence that he's giving us here.
Okay, got it. So it can still happen, but it's going to take more work on the querent's part, or they're really going to have to work for it.
Mm-hmm, precisely. And so the next step down then is striving, effort, and labor.
Got it. So those next two, or those final two that are sort of at the very bottom of the list, what's the situation with those?
Right. So the next step down, which is the second from the bottom, so you're getting into some real difficulties here to make this come about. He says, with striving, effort, and labor, you know, the matter will perfect with obstacles, labor, and great difficulty when the significator of the querent and quesited is joined by opposition with reception or by a square without reception. So before we had a square with reception, now we have a square without reception. So, you know, it's getting pretty shaky as to whether you're going to get the matter that you're asking about, because a large amount of effort will be required. Then, as you can imagine, just by the name, the opposition implies that, you know, your ability to get to the thing that you're asking about or to the person is going to be challenged. You're not together. You're opposed to each other in some way. But if there is reception, there's still perhaps a chance that you will be able to make this work out. And then the final step, he says, the matter will happen with labor or hardly at all, where he says the matter will perfect with the greatest labor, striving, effort, distress, and sadness. In other words, I'm not sure you really even want this, you know, think about it. Or it hardly, slowly, or never perfects even when the querent and quesited significators are joined by an opposition without reception. And so that's probably the worst case scenario, where you have an opposition, but there's no sign, there's no zodiacal relationship there at all. It'll be very difficult to get to the thing that you're asking about.
Okay, so the worst case scenario is an application between the two significators through an opposition, but with no reception. And at that point, that's like the weakest possible way that the Hori question could still come about, but it's going to take a huge amount of work on the native's part or the querent's part and it may not be worth it in the end if there's no reception.
That's been my experience. Sometimes you'll get what you want, but you kind of wish you hadn't gotten it. But, you know, I think just to take a step back, so all of this that we just talked about, all of this reception and aspect, this little table, that's just one of the subparts of consideration four. And that's what I was saying earlier, is that my goal with this project is to kind of unpack and unfold all of the subtleties and all of the shorthand, essentially, that's baked into the considerations.
Right. And that's brilliant, just because that material really could use that kind of unpacking or that kind of commentary and explication. And so I'm really glad that you're doing it for that reason, because there's some really useful and really brilliant sort of pearls of wisdom in there, but it really could use some work in order to bring it out to its fullest extent and to translate it for a modern audience. And the way that you're doing that, both through text and sort of commentary, but also through illustration and through visual graphics is really useful. So I wanted to focus on that one because I thought it was one of the more accessible ones that's immediately useful to people. But like you said, that's really just one subset of consideration four at this point, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty small piece. So we kind of zoom in with our microscope, but once you zoom out, you realize it's just one dot in the whole painting, as it were.
Right. So, okay, so let's move on to just some broader questions about other considerations. What are some of the other considerations that you find to be the most striking or the most compelling or the most useful in the rest of the work?
You know, one that I particularly find interesting, and I always feel like I'm trying to get this particular concept across, is 141. So that's obviously toward the very end, where he starts talking much more about natal astrology rather than just horary or electional. And 141 deals with the fixed stars, which of course are the stars that are in constellations, as opposed to the wandering stars, which are the planets. And he has a wonderful sort of explication and sort of a philosophical musing on the way that fixed stars seem to work in people's nativities. And he talks about how, you know, he quotes an Arabic text by Al-Mansur, where he will basically say, the fixed stars are the ones that bring people from depths of poverty into the heights of fortune and fame, which is something that even the planets cannot do. So in the medieval cosmology, the fixed stars were very far from the earth, because there was the earth, and then you had the spheres of the planets, kind of like the layers of an onion. And then outside of that were the fixed stars. And because the fixed stars were kind of somewhere out there, even beyond the planets, they were thought to be more perfect and more divine. And so they were at once more godly, but also removed from our human experience. So he said that the fixed stars can really bring about a level of success and a level of perhaps celebrity or fame that the planets could not give you, because the planets were kind of lower on that order. They were still a bit closer to the earth and therefore a little bit more imperfect. However, and so this aphorism, I would say, is fairly well known. You know, it's come down to us through other sources. But then he gives you this other half of it, which I think people often don't cite today or in general, which is that the fixed stars bring blessings that people lose. There is something about the nature of the fixed stars that, because maybe they're so divine or so far from us, our imperfect bodies and kind of the sphere of generation and corruption, which is how the earth was referred to in this cosmology, is unable to hold on to the blessings that the fixed stars bring. And so that's why the fixed stars might elevate you to a very high level of fame and fortune, but you will not necessarily be able to hold on to it. And you might come to a particularly bad end, because that's something that, you know, we're just so unable to grasp their gifts.
That's actually really interesting, because when I was glancing at some of the considerations or rereading them recently, one of them that caught my eye towards the very end is consideration 145, that's sort of tied in with that topic of fixed stars. And I'll just read it from Ben's translation really quick. It says, the 145th consideration is that you look to see in diurnal nativities if Corleonis, which is Regulus, were in the ascendant, namely in the eastern line, or above it only by 1 degree or less, or below it by 3 degrees, yada, yada, yada. because this will signify the native will have a great name and great power, likewise being exceedingly exalted, and that he will reach to sublime dignities, even if the native were found to be of the lowest class of parents. So I thought that was kind of funny, given, you know, some of the recent, you know, a very prominent person recently who's come into the news with Regulus conjunct the degree of the ascendant. And you have like this 12th century text that says, if a native is born with this specific fixed star conjunct the ascendant, then that's really important.
Yes, I think that's an aphorism that Bonatti says, and I think it comes up in other ways in other texts, but that's a great and very timely use of it. And so I think in this aphorism, as well as in 141, he then warns that, you know, these gifts are very difficult to hold on to. And then he goes into this whole, I would say, spiel. I think consideration 141 is, I don't know, like 4 or 5 pages long, where he essentially shows the, he discusses the biographies of several of his former employers, basically, even though he doesn't identify them as such, but they're all people that he is known to have worked for. And he illustrates how, even though they presumably had powerful fixed stars elevating them to great heights in their own ways, and, you know, they often ruled large parts of Italy and Europe and so on, ultimately they died potentially ignominious deaths, and their families were often wiped out by their enemies and so on. So it actually kind of goes into a somewhat dark place, I would say. And he just kind of keeps giving you examples one after the next. And even though he doesn't say it, he does seem to imply maybe that he has seen the charts of these individuals, and that presumably fixed stars are what was responsible for their pretty serious fates.
Okay, interesting. Well, I won't get into commentary then about current charts, but that ties in then to an earlier consideration, which is the 9th consideration. And if I'm remembering this correctly, it also focuses on the fixed stars, and he refers to them as being potentially secret helpers or secret harmers or something to that extent, based on their position in the chart or based on whether they're tied into important significators in the chart. Am I remembering that correctly, that's what that consideration or that notion of the fixed stars was, of them being secret helpers or secret
it is. And I'll be honest with you, kind of wondering how I'm going to convey this in my writing and illustration. He gives you essentially 21, sort of, again, kind of this graduated ladder of something called the strongest hidden helper to open helpers that are hidden and then weak. And then finally, the worst thing is the strong open harmer. And he discusses how the exact distance, I think to the minute, if I'm not mistaken, of certain fixed stars next to a house cusp is going to either harm the question or matter or native, depending on what kind of chart it is, either openly or in a hidden way, and how strongly. I would say that's how I would summarize that consideration.
Okay. That was always a really fascinating consideration to me, just conceptualizing it like that, because astrologers often, you know, it's true that astrologers often pay most attention to the planets, and that's sort of the primary thing in the chart. But then sometimes, you know, there's certain placements in the chart that really stand out or seem to be magnified for reasons that are not always immediately evident. And Bonatti seems to be emphasizing this notion that sometimes that's the fixed stars, which are sort of sitting behind the planets, especially if they're closely conjunct a planet, that can sometimes magnify that placement for better or worse. And that's kind of an interesting consideration to think about and explore from that perspective.
I think it is. And I think this consideration, when I first encountered it, it fascinated me as well. I think I had the same response as you. And I really haven't found anything quite like it in any other traditional text, where you have them the author go by minutes and degrees to show you how fixed stars might impact, you know, whatever you're asking about or the native. It's quite unique.
Definitely. Okay. So that's a really good and interesting consideration that's kind of useful or unique to Bonatti. Are there any other considerations where you feel like he sort of missed the mark, or that his meaning was unclear for some reason?
You know, I think, and this, luckily he doesn't do too much of it in the considerations, but I think he probably just can't help himself. So aphorisms sometimes can be so specific as to be almost ridiculous, because you'll often read it and you can think of an immediate counterexample, because the aphorism might say something very specific and you're like, well, no, that actually isn't the case for somebody whose chart I'm familiar with, for example. So one like that, and he doesn't have too many duds like that, but he does have one, is the 110th, where he basically says that if you were born with the sign of Scorpio rising, you will never make any progress. You will never have a career in the Catholic Church. And I think this could probably be translated to really any religious calling, but he particularly mentions the Roman Catholic Church. And the reason that he gives, let me see if I can get this right, is that if you have Scorpio rising, then Mars is your ascendant ruler. And that puts the sign Cancer on the ninth house cusp. And the ninth house, of course, rules religion and churches. And because the ninth house is ruled by Cancer, the planet Jupiter is exalted in the ninth, and Jupiter is associated with religion and churches in general. And because Mars and Jupiter are natural enemies, you and the church will forever be at odds, and you really shouldn't try to, get any kind of position in that organization.
Okay, right. So it's like you can see his logic. And that's probably some rationalization that he had at one point for maybe like a client chart and why this client was having such issues, you know, with the church or working in the church. And he sort of rationalized it from the perspective of if you have Scorpio rise, or maybe he saw that in a few charts. I don't know, but that there's an issue in terms of when you have Scorpio rising, that the exalted ruler of the ninth is Jupiter, which is contrary to Mars, or Mars is exalted in the opposite sign Capricorn. And so there sometimes seem to be conflicting significations. And that brings up an interesting point about just the nature of the aphorisms in general, which is that sometimes they're, you know, summarizing or outlining basic principles, but other times it's actually this more interesting, somewhat more interesting thing of almost like observations or anecdotes that the astrologer had about specific placements that they're attempting to sort of extract a universal interpretive principle from that, or at least what their interpretation or their conclusion was from the way in which that placement will manifest that they think could be applicable to other charts in some way, essentially, right?
I think that's a very good way of putting it, exactly. And sometimes, you know, sometimes they come up with a very, I would say, good and pithy aphorism that it really can be universalized or used in many cases. And other times you get something extremely specific that, you know, to me would very much, I think, hinge on a number of factors rather than just a single one in a chart.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, some of them were like that there, one of the statements he makes and one of the considerations is that you look at the rising sign for the question or for the natal chart, and then you look at the other, if it's a planet, if the domicile lord of that sign rules two signs, then the other sign that it rules, whatever house is on the cusp of that, it will immediately tie in or bring those topics into account in the question or in the natal chart. And then he goes through like a whole list of examples with that. Like if you have Virgo rising, then sometimes that means that Gemini will be on the cusp of the 10th house. And so therefore there's a connection between, or a strong connection between the first house and the 10th house. And therefore career matters will be more prominent. Or if, I think he says if like Taurus is rising, then that means that Libra will be on the cusp of the sixth house of illness. And so he says that sometimes that can mean that the native will somehow bring about their own injury or illness due to the connection between the first and the sixth and other things like that, right?
That's right. And those aphorisms do come up in other contexts. Definitely the illness and injury ones. I think those, either it's filtered down from Bonatti, and I don't know the exact provenance, but they do seem to pop up in things like medical, you know, medico-astrological texts of later eras.
Sure. And there's also some of the considerations, like consideration 64, sometimes he makes sort of like offhand comments. Like he says that if the moon is in Cancer or Taurus or Sagittarius or Pisces, that it's a positive indication regarding the matter inquired about or something like that, even if the moon is void of course, and that even if it's void of course in those signs, that it doesn't actually harm the moon in that instance, at least as not as much as when it's void of course in other signs. And then later we see that show up in authors like Lily, where he sort of generalizes that as a principle, saying that the moon being void of course is not a good thing for horary questions unless it's in one of these four signs, in which case it's almost sort of like an exemption or something like that.
And that's right. And I feel like a lot of these texts can be like that, where it's examples, but then exceptions, and then exceptions to exceptions. And this is one of those things where the void of course moon is sort of an exception to how the moon normally functions, except when she is, you know, in one of these four signs. And I think Bonatti even adds, it's not just the void of course sort of get out of jail free card, but also if she is in a bad aspect to a malefic planet. So if she's with Mars or Saturn, then in those cases, you know, even if she's one of these signs, she has a little bit more ability to act, and perhaps she can still bring about the desired outcome.
Sure. Yeah. And that's probably ultimately the most useful thing about, you know, the aphorisms as a genre, is just that it often is those, as you said, those exceptions to the rules. And it's the astrologer outlining oftentimes what they've seen as personal exceptions to the standard rule by saying, you know, typically this placement will indicate this, except when you also see this and this, then that will counteract the first consideration. And that's something that you often only learn from experience and from practice and from years of doing things. But it's something that really has to be passed on sometimes from teacher to student through that lived experience. And oftentimes it seems like that's what Bonatti's conveying in these considerations, is some of his experience in using some of these different factors in chart work, and what the exceptions are when you're applying some of them in practice.
Yes. And that's one of the reasons I like the considerations, is because it is a little bit like getting to sit in on a lecture, or at least getting the lecture notes from, you know, if Bonatti were actually teaching astrology. He, as you say, he is trying to convey some of his own observations and other parts of the book too. You can see he is somebody who, he doesn't seem to just necessarily be parroting old texts, but he will often say, you know, I've tried it out in this particular case and it worked like this. So there is definitely a sense that he's attempting to convey his own experience and what he has seen to you as the student.
Right. And that's one of the interesting things about him, because it's like, and about the tradition, or oftentimes the way that traditional texts were transmitted or presented, is that, you know, he will cite an earlier source, like, you know, Saul or something like that, and he'll outline what the tradition was or what this other author he was drawing on said. But then after that, he'll sometimes say, you know, however, I've seen it work like this, and that's my preferred opinion. And that's something you see as sort of a common thing, I feel like, throughout the tradition, because you see Vedius Valens doing something like that in the second century. Well, he'll outline what his predecessors did, but then he'll say, you know, it seems better to me like this. Bonatti sort of did the same thing. And you even see Lilly sometimes doing that as well, I think, right?
He does, absolutely. And, you know, he'll kind of give you the tradition, or what he understands to be the tradition, but then he might even, you know, subvert it entirely and say, however, I have found the opposite to be true, and really you should do something different.
Right. And then we have that as a sort of continuing thing today. And that's been part of the traditional revival, was first, you know, reviving a bunch of these texts and trying to initially go through an initial stage of understanding them and trying to figure out what the traditional author was trying to convey, and then separately applying some of that stuff in practice and seeing what worked, or seeing in some instances things that didn't work, or things that were interpreted in different ways, as well as sometimes, you know, different textual debates. I know there was a lot of debates, for example, over the past 20 or 30 years about the considerations before judgment, which ultimately go back to authors like Bonatti and Masha Allah. And there were different debates about, you know, when people looked at the chart examples in Lilly, that sometimes he would still answer questions that contained the considerations before judgment. And so there were different like interpretations about what that meant, and then what the significance was of the considerations before judgment, and whether they were still relevant, and other things like that. So there's this whole interpretive and like practical dialogue or process that takes place when working with some of these texts as well. And that's something that you're sort of doing and engaged in right now also.
It is. And, you know, one of the interesting things too, is that of course in the considerations, We might get examples of sort of chart placements, but you don't really get a complete chart to look at. So you don't get to judge whether Bonatti is really adhering to his rules at all times, as we do with some of the other authors, such as Lilly, who does give you a lot of charts where you can really critique whether what he's actually preaching, he's also practicing. And so one of the things that I've been trying to do, and I will do more of, I think, as I will continue my project, is to introduce some real charts and to show something taking place in real life, even though, of course, we don't know if Bonatti would agree with that chart because I'm the one who placed it in there. But it gives people a sense of, okay, here's what it plays out like in real life, and here's how things look like in practice. Because I think that is something that often we wish we had more of in a lot of these texts, is that we had more examples of how people actually use these rules and to what extent they're really adhering to them.
Right. Yeah. And reviving this, and in the process of doing that, you're reviving and making this, form of astrology from the 12th and 13th century, a living tradition again, by showing how it works in practice, and something that's been dead for 100 years, suddenly comes to life again through the chart examples and through the application and the demonstration of how these techniques and these concepts can actually work in practice with clients today and with example charts today. So for this, you're primarily using Ben's translation of the 146 considerations. And he, even though that was originally published in that large 1,000-page translation of Bonatti as just a small piece of it in 2007, he actually published in 2010 that as a standalone book, which is available as a paperback and as a Kindle book. It's just titled Bonatti's 146 Considerations. And that's really the primary thing that you're drawing on and that you recommend to other people who want to look into this, right?
It is. And I think it's a great place to start. If you're just wanting to kind of learn about the considerations initially, you can certainly find the original Lilly translation online. But I don't know that that would be a complete text, particularly if you're trying to follow along with, my work. I would definitely recommend that you, you get Ben's text. And of course, again, you're supporting somebody who's doing this as a labor of love. So, you're putting your money toward a good cause for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's incredibly cheap. It's only like 10 bucks or something in order to get the paperback version of that translation, I think, through Amazon,
right,
or through Ben's site or something similar, to buy like the Kindle version. So it's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So I definitely recommend that folks get that if they can.
Okay, excellent. And then they can read that. And so this project, I mean, you've kind of initiated a very long project here that it seems like it's going to take a while. Do you have any estimate of how long at your present pace, or given the extreme amount of like positive feedback that you've got, is that going to cause you to increase your pace with these, or do you have any estimate of how long you'll be doing this series of illustrations and commentary on the considerations?
I'm laughing because I actually had someone contact me who figured it out, who did the math. He said at my current pace, I think I was on track to complete it possibly within, I forget what he said, like 2.5 or 3 years or something like that. But I think that just depends, because some considerations are short and some are long. So I think that's an extremely rough estimate. But it's, it's one of those things that I'm just trying to do kind of, stepwise. And also with respect to the fact that people can only absorb so much knowledge in one go. If I was putting out a new, new notebook page a week or something like that, I think that would be probably too fast, given that most people have other things to think about. But, a couple times a month seems about the right amount where people can look at the page and examine it and hopefully, kind of ponder it a little bit.
Sure. And you've recently launched a page on Patreon where people can actually go and if they like what you're doing, they can actually support this work and help to encourage you to keep doing it and to do it more regularly, and also get some additional benefits and some additional sort of like side content that you're producing in concert with the primary illustrations, right?
Yes, that's right. So for those who aren't familiar, and I suppose if you're a listener on Chris's podcast, you have heard about Patreon because he's on that same system. But it's a, it's a website where you can essentially pledge a certain amount per post or per item that the creator puts out. And so in my case, you can pledge, $1, $2, or $5, or $10, or whatever. There are some higher tiers. And so every time I put out a new notebook page, which I usually do 2 to 3 a month, pretty steadily, then I would get whatever you pledged per post. And so with the rewards, so the first thing is if you do $1 per post, you get the notebook page about a week before the general public does, before I release it. If you pledge $2, then you get that, but also you can join kind of an exclusive discussion group that I've created where you can talk about the considerations and you can ask questions, because again, a lot of this stuff is new to many people and it's a chance to kind of ask me things directly. And then if you do the $5 tier, you can join a monthly class. It's a lecture. It's an online class that I do. You can join it and get a recording of it afterwards, even if you can't make it. And so there, you know, like I said, there are additional tiers. And if you go to patreon.com, Nina Griffin, or it's patreon.com/Nina Griffin, then you can kind of see the whole deal and you can sign up if it's something that you'd like to support. And I guess it's a very, you know, I kind of realize now, Chris, it's actually a very medieval way of being supported for one's astrological work in some way, apart from doing client work, don't you think? Kind of this concept of patronage.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically how, you know, guys like Banati wrote, you know, 1,000-page text in the 12th and 13th century, or how somebody like Claudius Ptolemy wrote many of his works. And you can see, you know, a number of the Hellenistic astrologers like Ptolemy dedicate their works to their patron at the time, because those were the people who, you know, were able to support that work financially and allow it to take place by giving the astrologer the ability to do creative work like that and to output things without having to worry about, you know, running off to make money in between writing like a 1,000-page, you know, comprehensive textbook on astrology. But instead, they could just focus all of their attention on that. And that is very much a classical and a medieval sort of approach to doing astrological work. So it's interesting to see it revived in modern times. And I know, you know, it's been amazing for me with the podcast, being able to have that sort of support from listeners and from the community, so that the podcast has been able to grow and expand and be much better than it ever would have been otherwise. And I'm excited to see other astrologers like yourself starting to find, you know, new and innovative ways to fund projects like this through Patreon, just because it allows for things that otherwise, like, you couldn't, you know, sustain like maybe a 2 or 3 or 5 year project to illustrate these without, you know, that sort of community support. And just the fact that things like that are available now is really amazing.
Absolutely. I don't know how crowdfunding would have worked in Bonatti's day, but I imagine there would have been a lot more. You actually have to walk around and like collect money or something every month for the work that you're doing. But it's interesting too. I mean, it's almost like, you know, you too can be like a medieval and Renaissance patron of the arts and of astrology, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. I think the crowdfunding back then was more lentil based.
That's right.
At that time, commodity wise.
Absolutely. If you're on the chicken tier, for example. Yep.
Right. The chicken tier or the lentil tier or.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we meant to mention that we didn't get a chance to. We gave sort of an overview of who Banati was. We talked about the different translations that are available. We touched on, you know, especially the early aphorisms that you're focused on right now, as well as some of the later ones where he keeps returning to the topic of the fixed stars. Are there any other points about the 146 considerations or Banati's aphorisms that you wanted to mention, or that we forgot to mention before we wrap this up?
I don't think I have anything additional. I would strongly recommend that people do get Ben's translation and just start reading it themselves, so they can kind of get familiar with the text. And it's nice because it's very bite-sized for the most part. So you're never really committed to kind of reading this enormous text. You can just read, you know, you can read one consideration a day if you like and really, really ponder it. So I would recommend that people simply get it and start engaging with it themselves.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great idea. And Ben has done a great service by breaking it up so that you can buy that as like a separate book, that you don't have to buy like the 1,000-page, you know, entire treatise on Banati's complete approach to astrology. But you can start by just buying this one book on considerations. And then if you want to expand from there, he also has some of the separate books available, like Banati's text on horary, or his text on elections and other parts of the book. So you can kind of build on that. So yeah, that's great. And I'd recommend everyone get that book of considerations, and then they can use that and kind of read along with you as you're going through the considerations and doing your commentary and your illustrations to get a better grasp of and to really understand the text better. So I know I already signed up to for your page on Patreon, so I'm already supporting that, and I'm excited to see the rest of the illustrations as they start to come out more and more in the future. And I definitely recommend that other people check that out. So your page on Patreon is at patreon.com/NinaGriffin, and your website is ninagriffin.com, right?
That's right. And of course, you can also find me on Facebook under Nina Griffin, as well as on Instagram. And I usually post on all of these things more or less simultaneously. So if you're on at least one platform, you can find me.
Excellent. And I know that I asked this early on, and I don't know if you were at that stage. I'm sure other people have. I know other people have suggested it or recommended or requested it at this point. But do you have any plans in the long term, or how do you feel about maybe turning this into a print book at some point in the future?
I would very much like to turn it into a print book. I am currently investigating exactly what I would need to make that happen. In particular to, you know, how can I convey the illustrations sort of accurately so that when it comes out in print, it's attractive and the colors are accurate and all of that. But I think if I can get the quality to where I want it in a way that is affordable to people, because of course that's important, I very much would like to turn it into a print book. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing the Patreon as well, is that, you know, with a little bit of financial support, it'll be easier to get a higher quality publication ultimately.
Definitely. Well, that's what I'm definitely holding out for in the long term. And that's one of the reasons I'm supporting you through Patreon, because I'd love to see this as a print book in the future, because I always think about, you know, what books from our time period are going to survive the next century or like two or three centuries. And I could see your commentary on Bonatti, your illustrated commentary, surviving, and then like somebody 1,000 years from now trying to unpack that and figure out your commentary and sort of doing studies, or like somebody writing a dissertation on Nina Griffin's commentary on Bonatti's Considerations. And for some reason, I can see that happening. So I'll be pulling for a print book happening one of these days.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. I hope so as well. I hope that the dissertation includes some thoughts about why I included certain cute animals for certain considerations. I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, there's going to be like a whole subsection in the dissertation on the significance of the hedgehog on the first page, and like, why is he, does he have a thought bubble with an apple? And it's going to be very detailed.
That's what I'm thinking. Yes.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you a lot for joining me today. And yeah, I look forward to having you on again in the future to talk about other considerations and other projects.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate it. I had a great time chatting with you.
All right. Well, everyone, you can check out Nina's website once again at ninagriffin.com for more information about her project. And yeah, so check it out. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you again next time.